One of Hollywood's biggest stars of the 1950s and 60s was also one of the first actors to run his own production company. Now he is the father of one of today's biggest stars and producers. My guest, Kirk Douglas, has made about 75 films, including Champion, Ace in the Hole, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Lust for Life, Paths of Glory, Spartacus, Lonelier the Brave, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Tough Guys. Douglas is the son of poor, illiterate Russian-Jewish immigrants. He chronicles his life on and off screen in his new autobiography, The Ragman's Son. Kirk Douglas has one of the most distinctive voices in film, and when his career was at its peak, it was de rigueur for every comic who did impressions to do Douglas in their act. I wanted to know what Douglas thinks of his own voice.
I never considered that I had a particularly good voice, although obviously it must be somewhat distinctive because when people are doing imitations of me, they rely on certain aspects of my voice. But I am bad at imitating voices. For example, if I'm on the telephone and I try to pretend I'm someone else, someone says, "Oh, Kirk," and I thought I was giving a very good imitation of someone else's voice.
So you thought that there were certain shortcomings with your voice. Did you ever do anything to try to change it or improve on what you saw as its shortcomings?
No, I mean, I've taken the usual dramatic school, the usual lessons in voice production and all that. And I tried to make, I want a voice that comes out of me, not a voice that's, really very mellow and very deep and, very often those beautiful voices are disconcerting. They don't seem sincere. You become aware of a beautiful voice instead of the feeling and thoughts that someone is saying. You know what I mean, Terry?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's hear how your voice sounded in 1949 in your first real starring role, the film Champion. And you played a boxer who the world sees as this just great idealized champion, but you've treated everyone like garbage on the way up.
That was one of the first anti-hero movies.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a scene from early in the movie. You've just won a fight. You realize you can actually box. But your brother, played by Arthur Kennedy, is worried about what he saw in you when you were punching away in the ring.
"I kept thinking you were hitting a lot of guys, different guys, all the guys that ever hurt you. I can't put my finger on it, but there's something wrong about that. I don't know if that's so good, especially in this business. And if you want to know, I don't like this business either. You're talking kid stuff, crazy stuff. Listen, I want to fight. My first fight, that's all. You hear that crowd? The first time in my life people cheering for me. Were you deaf? Didn't you hear them? Oh, Connie, wake up. Smell of coffee. Smell of steaks. Oh, I see you're learning, too. That's more like it. Get smart. I got my foot on the ladder. We're not hitchhiking anymore. We're riding."
You play a character who becomes more and more of a heel as he gets more and more successful. And I was wondering if that role set the tone at all for the kinds of roles you were offered afterwards.
Well, that as I listen to those words, it's really the tone of the book that I wrote. It's the, I always say there's a part of every actor in each role that he plays.
Uh-huh.
And as I listen to that, I can see that while I was writing The Ragman's Son, that's the quality that I had a long time ago.
Which quality are you speaking of?
I mean, the quality of trying to get from nowhere to somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you start on the bottom, you have, as I tell my sons, they didn't have my advantage. Because I had the advantage of coming from abject poverty, so I had nowhere to go but up. If I were born in a certain amount of affluence, I don't know what I would have done. See, so I had the stimulation, just as boxers today, they're hungry. In Champion, Mitch Kelly was hungry. He wanted to be champion. You know, when he says smell of coffee, smell of steak, he wanted to get somewhere. So he was properly motivated. And in a sense, I think my background, when I was writing this book, I learned an awful lot about myself, because you go through life and you forget, you get wrapped up in what you're doing, you get wrapped up in a make-believe world. The characters that I play in movies become more real to me than myself things around me, because I'm so wrapped up in these characters that I'm portraying on the screen. And also, in years ago, unlike today, we did one movie after the other. So I was constantly having a great deal of myself in the world of make-believe.
Kirk Douglas is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography, which is titled The Ragman's Son. In the scene that we just heard, you give almost a little soliloquy there, and there have been several of your movies where, you know, one of your great moments in the film is a little soliloquy. And I was wondering if those are the moments that you really reach for, that you really like when you're acting in a movie, if that's, to you, the glory moment of a film or not.
Well, I don't think of it as a soliloquy. I think of soliloquies in Shakespearean plays, you know, to be or not to be, and all those things. But I suppose they are soliloquies in that you have a moment where someone expresses his innermost feelings. And then that particular moment that you displayed on in Champion, that's a very key moment of understanding who this character was, and seeing that the other characters began to see a sort of viciousness in him that was almost frightening. You know, when Paul Stewart's character says, "I don't know, when I looked at you, gee, it looked like you were killing everybody that you hated in your life." You know, they saw this element that was a part of that person, and in a strange way, is a little part of me, Issa Danielovich.
You started off in your first movie playing someone who is pretty weak in the film The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, and you went on to become a character who was seen as very strong. In fact, you mentioned that Ilya Kazan refers to you in his autobiography, and I'd like to read one of the things that he says when he was making the film The Arrangement, based on his best-selling novel. You wanted to be in the film, and he cast you in it, although he says there was something about the role that he thought Marlon Brando would have been better for. And Ilya Kazan writes, "There was one problem with Kirk. Eddie, the character, has to start defeated in every personal way. The film rests on how basic and painful his initial despair is. Kirk has developed a professional front, a man who can overcome any obstacle. He radiates indomitability. Marlon, on the other hand, with all his success and fame, was still unsure of his worth and of himself. Acting had little to do with it. It was all a matter of personality." Did you ever think of yourself that way, as just radiating indomitability, and that affecting the kind of roles you could or cannot do well?
Working with Kazan in The Arrangement was a wonderful experience. He's a great director. But I disagree with him completely. When I did Lust for Life, which I consider one of the most intriguing roles that I've played, I played a man completely unsure of himself. As a matter of fact, I sometimes tell my fellow actors that no one can play weakness better than I, starting with the very first movie that I did, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers. And then when you go to a character like Lust for Life, I remember the first time we showed that, and I described this incident in my book, where John Wayne was drinking at a party after a showing. He was very annoyed. He motioned me, brought me out on the balcony, and said, he was very annoyed. He said, "Kirk, how can you play such a sniveling, weak character?" And I said, "Well, John," I said, "well, you know, I'm an actor. It was an interesting role. I wanted to play it." "No, no," he said, "Kirk, we've got to play tough, macho guys." And he was really upset that I would be playing such a weak character. And you just read me a section where Kazan says that I just have that indomitable spirit. He must have been carried away by some other movie, because if you look at Lust for Life, the pathetic, you know, tragic aspects of a man who really didn't know what he was, who couldn't sell a painting, who wasn't sure that he was he a homosexual? He didn't know quite what he was. And those were the facets of the character that excited me. Although most people, I think of me, the last movie I did with Burt Lancaster was called Tough Guys, as sort of a tough guy. But I love to play parts, or try to find parts, with different dimensions. You see, Terry, if I play a strong man in a film, I look for the moments where he's weak. And if I play a weak character, I look for the moments where he's strong, because that's what drama's all about, chiaroscuro, light and shade.
Mm-hmm. You were one of the first actors to actually start their own production studio. You produced Lust for Life, which you were just talking about. You produced Spartacus.
No,
you didn't produce
that?
I thought you did do that.
I wanted to produce Lust for Life. I've produced
Spartacus,
Viking, Paths of Glory, Lonely Are the Brave. I wanted to produce Lust for Life, and I went to buy it and found MGM said, "We own it." And I said, "Oh, I want to play that part." And I ended up playing the part with Vincent Minnelli, but I didn't produce it, no.
Why did you want to start your own production company? Did you feel like you didn't have enough freedom as an actor?
You know, because that was a very unique thing at that time. But I wanted a production company so that I could find something that I wanted to do and then try to develop it. And sometimes I was very successful at doing that, Spartacus, Paths of Glory. But sometimes I was very unsuccessful, as when I bought One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and had it for 10 years and shopped it all over town, and nobody wanted to do it until my son Michael said, "Look, Dad, let's be partners. Let me see if I can get the money." And he went outside of the industry and got the money, and the rest is history.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the film Spartacus, in which you both starred and produced. I think it's an interesting movie for a lot of reasons, so I want to spend some time on it. Now, you had starred in The Vikings, and you write in your new autobiography, The Ragman's Son, that after starring in The Vikings, you thought, "That's it, no more epics for me." And then you go and turn around and actually produce one of the real big epics, Spartacus. Why did you want to make an epic?
Well, I didn't want to make an epic. And one of the first things I said to my group, I said, "Look, if we do this picture, Spartacus, let's make it as if it were a small picture." And to me, if you look at Spartacus again, you will find that the characters dominate the background. Most pictures, Ben-Hur and all that, the background is so enormous. But in Spartacus, Olivier, Lawton, Ustinov, Gene Simmons, the characters are stronger than the background. And that's what I try to do. In spite of the fact that it was an epic picture, I wanted the characters to be, for them to be larger than life.
You mentioned the characters and some of the actors. You ended up casting Gene Simmons in the role of Spartacus's lover and the woman who he has a baby with. And initially you didn't want to cast her because she's British, and you thought that that would ruin the linguistic pattern of the movie. And I'd love for you to explain what you meant by that.
Well, I have a very simple... For example, when I did The Vikings, all the Vikings are Americans. We have a rougher pattern of speech. The English have a more elegant pattern of speech, so that makes it work. In Spartacus, you'll notice that all the aristocratic Romans are English.
That's right. They're great,
the slaves,
great stage actors, great British stage actors.
The slaves, like myself, were Americans.
Not only that, ethnic, right? Jewish, Italian. You, Jewish, Tony Curtis, Italian. No, Tony Curtis is Jewish too, actually, isn't he?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. I always forget that.
But it doesn't matter. You see, it's just that Americans have a rougher speech pattern. For example, I often think that Shakespeare very often is better played when it's done in the United States, because those beautiful lines take on a rougher quality that I think Shakespeare really intended it.
So the slaves have the rough quality, and the Romans have the more genteel, educated, refined sound.
Exactly. Of course.
Is this intentional? Is this standard, or is this just something you wanted to do? Do you think it's pretty standard in epics of that period to cast that way?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way. It was just, you know, my way of looking at the picture. And of course, Spartacus, you picked on a picture that is a big section in my book, because so much happened during the making of Spartacus. The most historical event was the breaking of the blacklist. And that's one of the reasons that Spartacus is so important to me.
Well, that's right. Well, Dalton Trumbo was writing it under a pseudonym, like he was writing all of his screenplays at the time, because he was blacklisted. And you insisted that for this movie he actually use his real name. Did you think that the time was right where you could say, "This is Dalton Trumbo who wrote the movie," and where it would actually be accepted, that the time was right to break the blacklisting and have it be accepted, at least in part of Hollywood?
Well, I'm not so sure. I did it rather impulsively. I don't think I was aware until a couple years later, as I reflected upon it, and as I explain in my book, I began to see, the significance of it. What bothered me when I did Spartacus was the hypocrisy in Hollywood, that these people, some of them who spent a year in jail for a crime that was never very clearly stated, were denied denied using their talents except behind the scenes. Studio heads would look the other way while a lot of these unfriendly 10 writers would be writing scripts for very little money. So it was so hypocritical that it annoyed me to the extent that I said, well, what happens? We had a discussion of whose name are we going to put on the screen of Spartacus. And suddenly I said, well, what happens if I put Dalton Trumbo's name on? And they said, oh, Kirk, you're bound. He said, you're going to get out of the business and all that. I said, no, the hell with it. I'm going to do it. And the next day I left the pass. Dalton Trumbo hadn't been on a set in 10 years. I left the pass for Dalton Trumbo. No Sam Jackson. Of course, even Sam Jackson, we wouldn't have allowed on the set. Somebody might have recognized him as Dalton Trumbo.
That was his pen name for this movie.
Yes, and from then on, I'll never forget when Dalton Trumbo walked on the set, came over to me and says, Kirk, thanks for giving me back my name. There were people who, I got letters from different organizations, had a Hopper attack me, but the sky didn't fall in. And after that, a few months after that, Otto Preminger announced that Dalton Trumbo was going to be writing this script, and the blacklist was broken.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. Actor and producer Kirk Douglas is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography which is titled The Ragman's Son. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kirk Douglas, and he's written a new autobiography titled The Ragman's Son. Since we're talking about Spartacus, let me play a clip from the movie. And this is toward the end of the first half of the film. Remember, this movie had an intermission. And Spartacus and many other slaves have escaped from slavery. And after they've escaped, many of the slaves are just drinking wine. They're having Romans fight each other as if the Romans were slaves. And Spartacus is saying, what are you doing with your lives? You should be doing something more productive. And he suggests that they actually fight the Roman Empire.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? Have we learned nothing? What's happening to us? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
We can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators. An army of gladiators. There's never been an army like that. One gladiator's worth any two Roman soldiers that ever lived.
We beat the Roman guards here, but a Roman army's a different thing. They fight different than we do, too.
We can beat anything they send against us if we really want to.
It takes a big army for that, Spartacus.
We'll have a big army. Once we're on the march, we'll free every slave in every town and village. Can anybody get a bigger army than that?
That's right. Once we cross the Alps, we're safe.
Nobody can cross the Alps. Every pass is defended by its own legion.
There's only one way to get out of this country.
The sea.
What good is the sea if you have no ships?
The Cilician pirates have ships. They're at war with Rome. Every Roman galley that sails out of Brundusium pays tribute to them.
They've got the biggest fleet in the world. I was a galley slave with them. Give them enough gold and they'll take you anywhere.
We haven't got enough gold.
Take every Roman we capture and warm his back a little. We'll have gold all right.
Spartacus is right. Let's hire these pirates and march straight to Brundusium.
Well, they get their army, and you, as Spartacus, lead them against the Roman army. When you were leading the army in the battle scene in Spartacus, was the real actor Kirk Douglas worried about production costs?
No, when you're acting, even though you have a production company, you try to cooperate with the people who are financing the production. But as an actor, that's my most important aim, my most important concern. So believe me, when I'm playing a scene in Spartacus, I can't be thinking about production costs.
I think the battle scene in Spartacus where the slave army and the Roman army fight is one of the most interestingly choreographed movie battle scenes. The slaves are massed in almost a checkerboard foundation formation. There are people in the slave and the Roman army as far as you can see. It is this huge vista of people. And I'm wondering what your most vivid memory of being in the middle of all of that is.
Well, you see, all of that was historically accurate. We studied how Romans fought, you know, and how they arranged their armies. And, of course, that was a scene. We shot the entire picture in the United States except for those scenes, which we shot in Spain, because you needed so many people, and we used lots of Spanish soldiers. The battle scenes were all shot in Spain because it needed thousands of people.
You know the scene where the slave army gets started by burning logs in front of the army, and then they roll the logs down the hill. So these flaming logs force the Roman army to retreat. And you see in the movie a lot of Roman soldiers getting burned by these logs. How'd you do that?
Well, listen, those are the scenes. We don't discuss how we do. You don't have a magician telling you how you do a trick. That was a very effective device. That we had a very talented director, Stanley Kubrick, who was doing it. But that in itself is not a very difficult thing to shoot, to have burning logs rolling into soldiers. But it was very effective.
There is a scene at the end that is a mass crucifixion, and you're one of the many actors on the cross at the end of the movie. And I'd really like to know how you were attached to the cross so that you could hang there without really hurting yourself.
Well, as a matter of fact, playing that scene, we learned an awful lot about crucifixion. We learned that it would be impossible to be crucified the way very often you see a crucifixion. You know, the body would sag right down. But to make our scenes effective, it was very easy. Every cross had a bicycle seat that just kept the body up high enough so that you wouldn't be sagging down in a very unattractive position.
Okay, so that's the secret. Kirk Douglas is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography, which is titled The Ragman's Son. You quote your wife in your book, who once said to you, it's an unnatural life just being wrapped up in make-believe characters. You've played so many different characters through the course of your career. Were you ever confused about who you really were as opposed to who the characters you played were?
Well, the only time I encountered something similar to that was in playing Lust for Life. Van Gogh really was a painful character to play, and it was so easy to study his character because there's a whole book of letters that he wrote to his brother. And reading those letters, you could understand him so perfectly. And shooting the picture, we shot it in Auvers-sur-Oise and Arles, Les Baux, all the places that Van Gogh lived. And when I came to the town of Auvers-sur-Oise, where Van Gogh died, and I had this stubby red beard and kinky red hair in the outfit, a lot of the old-timers, they actually felt as if Van Gogh had come back. So there was an amazing resemblance that I must have had to Van Gogh, and that all affected me. And the poignancy of that role did really get to me, and it destroyed my original concepts of what acting is all about, where you're supposed to have the discipline of knowing that this is make-believe. And I never watched Lust for Life until about 6 months after it was finished. I just didn't want to even be close to it. It was a painful experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, we started this interview with me asking you about your voice, which is surely one of the most distinctive facets of your acting style. I want to ask you something about you physically in terms of your acting. People think of you, they think of your voice. Physically, they really think of the dimple in your chin. And when you started acting, was there ever a time where that was seen as a disadvantage? Did anyone ever try to cover that up with makeup?
Oh, yeah. The first time I came to Hollywood, you know, and they're looking at this Broadway actor. There was talk of And they did. They filled it up with putty.
Really?
It had to be an awful lot of putty because I don't have a dimple in my chin. I have a hole in my chin. And it annoyed me. I said, look, I just pushed the putty out. I said, look, this is what you get if you want it. I'm not going to change it. So let me know if this is what you want or I'm going back to New York. And that was the end. I mean, and since then, I've never, you know, it's a part of me.
So you never let them actually shoot you with the putty in your chin?
No, because if I wanted to play, oh, I would do that if there was a real reason where I wanted someone to have like a big lantern jaw and covering up this dimple in my chin would give me that effect. I would do it if the reason was to play a certain character or it's covered up when you have a beard. I mean, I do whatever I feel you have to do to play the character, not for, you know, vanity's sake. I am what I am. I can't change that.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Kirk Douglas, and he's written a new autobiography titled The Ragman's Son. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.